Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. So we have a change in plans for this week's episode. Originally, it was going to be with Magda talking about serving 5-MeO-DMT up there in Canada. We had a very good conversation just the other week, but we did have some issues come up with the interview, so we're going to need to redo that, and that's going to happen later this week. So rather than having Magda on for this week, I got busy reading the book Listening to Ecstasy by Charles Winninger, and that's what we've got for the podcast for this week, is a lovely conversation with Charles joining me from the East Coast of the United States. A rather unique perspective on MDMA as someone in his early 70s, and a very personal book about how his experiences with MDMA and his wife have helped to transform his life and make his later years far more pleasurable and interesting. I do not have anybody to thank this week for making a contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. If you would like to support this podcast, as I always say every week, it's quite easy to do, though not many people do it. You just head on over to my personal webpage, martinball.net. You can use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can choose to join as a regular contributor over at Patreon, which also is available through the top right of my personal webpage, martinball.net, and my Patreon page is patreon.com/martinwball, with a variety of different levels, with access and gifts and things like that. I always enjoy getting support for the podcast. I put a lot of work and time into this, so if you enjoy listening, hey, throw a couple bones my way. That'd be great. I'd appreciate that. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Charlie. And once again, his book is Listening to Ecstasy. His website is listeningtoecstasy.com. The subtitle is The Transformative Power of MDMA. This book was released in 2020, so it's still relatively new. And here's my conversation with Charles Winninger on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. Please enjoy. My guest today on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast is Charles, also known as Charlie Winninger, and he is the author of a book that I just finished reading this morning, Listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA. And, you know, I'm sort of best known for my enthusiasm around 5-MeO-DMT, but I'm also a huge fan of MDMA. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful molecule, and really in agreement with, I think, sort of the main message of your book is that I feel that human beings definitely have a right to feel good and to enjoy themselves and to literally experience ecstasy, because that's what MDMA can do. And I think that it's a very powerful, powerful feeling, and it's hard for people to obtain that experience. And so it's one of those things that I wish everybody would try, because I do think that to give themselves the gift of having that beautiful experience is just so powerful. So I just wanted to lead off with that I'm really in agreement with you. And so it was a great pleasure to read your book.
Well, thank you, Martin. one of the themes of the book is that fun and joy and pleasure can actually be transformative experiences.
Yes.
And, you know, in this culture, we tend to devalue those parts of life and say, well, MDMA is just a recreational drug, and that's sort of a disparaging word. I prefer to say it's a celebrational drug.
Yeah, that's a good term.
To know that level of joy, fun, and pleasure is, I believe, our birthright.
Absolutely.
And it's also, you know, the pursuit of happiness is our American birthright. So it all fits in.
It certainly does. And it's interesting that in psychedelic culture, I do find that there's a couple different biases against MDMA. One is many people in psychedelic culture are into this whole, which I think is a completely artificial divide, this notion of, well, some things are natural, and then something that's made in a lab, well, that's not natural, so it's not necessarily good. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that are like, plant medicine, it's all about plant medicine, but man, if you made it in a lab, no, I'm not interested in supporting that. And then also this idea that I think kind of goes through a lot of psychedelic culture is the idea that psychedelics or altered states should be serious, and you should be focused on the work, and that you've got to take it really seriously, and it has to be a serious ceremony. And I think that there's room for that, but there's also just room for having a good time and enjoying yourself. And so I'm curious how, I mean, you mentioned various biases. I mean, even just the one about like, oh my God, you're doing drugs. Like, whoa. The reaction that other people have. But you've kind of written this love ode to MDMA. And I'm just curious if you've experienced some of that pushback within psychedelic culture itself.
A little. Albert Hofmann, who, of course, was the one who discovered LSD and brought it to the world, said that people who make that distinction between the synthetic and the natural when it comes to these mind-altering drugs don't really get the nature of consciousness. It all has to do with how these medicines impact your consciousness. The source doesn't matter. What matters is what it does for you as a human being. And I believe when it comes to MDMA, I really espouse the middle way. In other words, on the one hand, there is the type of seriousness that you just described, and that goes hand in hand with all the clinical research, and how MDMA is going to be a prescription medication in a few years because it is having enormous effect at helping people get over their PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's a serious clinical research and deep healing that's going on. On the other end of the spectrum, there's rave culture, where people like to drop some MDMA and get lost in ecstatic abandon with 10,000 others for the night, which is fabulous and has its own validity. I believe in the middle way, which is what I like to call serious fun. Of getting together with one other person, like a romantic interest, or with friends, for the purpose of just exploration, for the purpose of getting in touch with, I call MDMA the chemical of connection. Of connecting with yourself, connecting with another person, connecting with whoever's in the room with you, to explore, to expand the boundaries between you, and connect in a profound way. And that can be great fun. It can include dancing, but it can also just include talking for the night and connecting in a very joyful, pleasurable, and deep and intimate way. And that's what I like to do the best.
Yeah. And I like the idea that, you know, it's great when these psychedelic medicines and molecules are used to help people heal, especially from deep traumas and wounds and things like that. But it doesn't need to be limited to that. It doesn't,
right?
That it's not just about healing, that there also is the joy of living life and the joy of the novelty of psychedelic experience and the exploration and
yes,
in exploring new realms of intimacy, new realms of communication. And in a sense, I like to say that kind of all human beings are traumatized just by being human beings, just the fact that we're self-aware. And so we're able to ask the question of like, my God, where am I? What's going on? What's the purpose?
who am I? What am I supposed to do?
And oh God, I'm going to die one day.
Yes. Yes. That we have awareness of our own mortality, that in and of itself is difficult for human beings to digest. And so anything that can make that experience be enriched and to achieve more depth, more connection, more self-understanding. You know, we don't need to come from a traumatic background or a war situation to deserve those kinds of experiences as human beings.
Amen. I like what you're saying. And my wife, Shelley, and I have done MDMA about 75 times since we met 21 years ago when we were about 50 years old. Now we're in our early 70s. And it's had a cumulative effect, infusing our whole relationship, our whole marriage, with elements of joy and pleasure, and a very deep and profound intimacy. And over time has made us lighter.
Yes. Well, since you mentioned your age, and I'm sure people can hear it in your voice, no judgment mm-hmm. intended in any way,
but yeah, no.
Definitely you are an older gentleman. And so you got to talk a little bit about your history and how you came to MDMA. So maybe let's go ahead and get into that. And Shelley is a big character in your book and about your experiences together. So tell us a little bit about your background and also your work as a therapist, and mm-hmm. then how you got into MDMA and what that discovery was like for you.
How much time do we have?
We have as much time as we want. I love open-ended conversations. There's okay, no limit. Well,
thanks. I've been a psychotherapist for the past 30 years. I've been a psychonaut for the past 50 years. I was married once and had the painful experience of divorce. And I met Shelley in 2000 and instantly recognized that this was an unusual person and offered me an unusual opportunity because she was not a psychonaut. She never even finished a joint in her life when she met me. She was a nurse. She went right out of high school, right into nursing school, a straight line, a straight life, never experimented with any of these medicines. But when she met me, she was freshly out of a marriage herself. She was, and it was a repressive experience for her. She wanted to spread her wings. And when she found out that I had this, what do you call it? I wouldn't call it a hobby because that sounds too trivial. An interest in, mm-hmm. in psychedelics. She said she wanted to try it. And she wanted to try MDMA. And I was floored because of her history, and because at that point in the year 2000 and 2001, I had given up MDMA. I had done it in the 90s. I didn't know about the protocols at the time. I didn't know about having to adequately hydrate. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about a lot of things. And I had some bad experiences, or especially afterwards, Tuesday blues and that sort of thing. So I was very hesitant and a little reluctant, but she wanted to try it. And I thought, okay, I don't want to deny that to her. So I did some research, found some pure MDMA, and we've only always used pure MDMA, and have a testing kit to make sure of that, and got a scale to measure it, so we did it just right. And I learned about the protocols because I felt responsible for her experience.
Yeah.
And decided, okay, I'll do it with her. And that first time we did it together, I was able to procure a friend's house. They were away, and we did house sitting for the weekend upstate New York, where it's gorgeous in the summertime. And when it came on for her, it looked like she was waking up from a long sleep. And she just started gently touching her arms and her legs. And as you know, it's not particularly a sexual drug, although it can be used with sex, but it's more a sensual drug. And she looked like she was just coming alive. And from that point, she knew that this was a second love affair she was having, not just with me, but with this medicine. And it was a unique way for us to bond. And in turning her onto it, I got returned to it and realized that with the proper protocols in place, we don't have to have a downside. And I say, we've done it 75 times together in the past two decades. We have never had the Tuesday blues.
Yeah. So something that really stuck out for me is sort of your description of meeting Shelley and how she didn't fit sort of this image that you had in your mind of who you thought your next partner would be. And also from your previous experiences that you had kind of developed this disposition that, well, a relationship should have lots of challenges and have lots of drama. And, you know, I want someone that I can argue with philosophically. And here's someone presenting you with a very different take on what a relationship could be. So it sounds like that even letting go of those expectations for yourself and what, you know, this is one of the major obstacles in life, right? When people get, no, this is what I want. And if I don't get that, then it's not the right thing and might not be open to what actually is presenting itself. But you were able to embrace that.
Over time, yes. Yeah. I was a little slow to embrace it. At first, I really didn't realize what I had with Shelley. My head didn't realize what my heart knew from the start, which was that I was crazy in love with her. But it took a while for me to catch up for my head to catch up because she wasn't meeting my laundry list of criteria like you just described. I thought a relationship had to be about work and struggle. And with Shelley, it was just easy. All she was doing, she wasn't satisfying my need for drama or deep, harrowing arguments about sexual politics deep into the night. All she was doing was making me happy. And it was hard for me at the beginning to realize that that was more than enough. We were unusually compatible. And so it was an awakening for me. And just like, I guess I would liken my first marriage, and I take responsibility for this, I'm not blaming her, my first marriage to like a heroic dose of psilocybin, where it's like I'm strapped to the chair saying, oh my God, here we go, for the whole relationship, like a nightmare roller coaster ride. And I say I take responsibility at least as much as it's hers. And Shelley was more like MDMA. Mm-hmm. And MDMA was a revelation. You mean I could have just a wonderful, enlightening, fabulous time with the medicine? You mean I can have just a wonderful, fabulous, transformative time and a happy time with a human being? And it doesn't have to be rough and tough. These were like revelations to me.
Yeah. And I think that that's just a great question that maybe everybody can ask themselves is, when is the last time I genuinely had a wonderful time?
Hmm.
and really feel into that and really ask yourself, well, do I want that in my life? Do I want a wonderful
time? I deserve it.
Yeah. And, that's such a good one, because that's something that I've found, you know, in all my work with psychedelics and with individuals and counseling people and consulting with them, like the question I always come back to with people is, and it's very powerful sometimes when I ask people this, because they might break into tears right away, and I ask them, do you love yourself?
Yeah.
And do you feel that you are worthy? And the reality is that a lot of people don't. They don't know how to love themselves, and that it's deep-seated within a lot of people, that this idea that they are not worthy of experiencing divine grace or experiencing ecstasy or just having a wonderful time, that there's this deep-seated sense of self that I should struggle, I should be punished, it should be hard, I am not worthy.
Yeah, I was one of those people. MDMA eventually talked me out of that belief, and had a lot to say to me. I started listening, and that's why I call the book Listening to Ecstasy. It had a lot to teach, a whole curriculum, and a lot of it was about just what you're talking about, realizing that I'm lovable and worthy of love just by the just because I'm here.
Yeah.
We all go through a trauma of birth, and we're all going to face our demise, and how we spend the time between is up to us, and we're here to make the most of it. And I believe we're really here to pull heaven down to earth and realize that we are here for love, starting with ourselves and then focused outward, because it's contagious. And we're here to transform ourselves and the people around us and the world around us.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful orientation. And it's another one that I like to highlight, that it seems to me that so many spiritual traditions kind of promote this idea of escape or getting out, whether it's the afterlife or heaven or nirvana or moksha or getting out of the wheel of samsara. There's always this notion of going away, of getting out, being done. And I like the reverse side of that is, like I say, well, the human being is always trying to get out, but God's just trying to get in. And so really it's about what we're bringing into ourselves. It's not about transcending and going away. For me, it's about really being here with that full presence. And
MDMA helps you embody that presence, because it's a body medicine.
Yes.
It really speaks to the body. And like, I don't know about you, Martin, but when I'm rolling on MDMA, I've never physically have felt better in my life. It's like I didn't realize my body could feel so wonderful.
Yeah.
And it can be such a joy to be alive.
Yeah. And especially the tactile nature of it. You know, like you were describing Shelley, like feeling her arms and feeling her body, and just that sensation of, my God, it feels good just to touch myself and just to be in my body. And then, especially, I mean, you talk a lot about music. When we add in some auditory stimulation of some music that really gets us going, just that sense of pleasure. Actually, so I'll share a brief personal story with you about MDMA. So I'm a musician, and in recent years, something that I have adopted is when I finish recording music, I like to take some MDMA, and then I'll listen to the album, you know, and see how I feel about it. So this was quite a few years ago now, but had recorded an album with my wife, and I did all the music and she did the singing, and I was writing the lyrics for her, and I wrote a song that was her singing to our son, Jaden. It was when he was just, you know, like 2 or 3 years old is when we wrote this song together. So anyway, I'm rolling on MDMA. I'm all alone. I'm on my bed. I've got my headphones on. And this song comes on. And the name of the song is Bright Eyes Becoming. And the song starts and just this pleasure in my ears. It's just like, oh my God, oh my God. And then her voice comes on. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to have an orgasm in my ears. And then...
an eargasm.
Yes. And I have never experienced this before or since, but the best way I can describe it is I literally had eargasms that both of, I mean, it was because there was just this sense of love in the song, and I was just overcome by it, and it was so incredibly pleasurable. Yes, there was joy and love and connection, and it's even making me feel a little teared up in communicating this to you. But it was the most extreme pleasure I have ever had from music, and it was all in my ears, and my head just exploded. I mean, it was fantastic, wow. Absolutely fantastic.
That's really a peak experience.
Yeah,
it really is. That's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I love it.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. You know, I was thinking of like some other MDMA experiences I've had more recently, but I hadn't even thought of that one until we were just talking right now. But yeah, so let's talk about music. And because this also was kind of your entry into the East Coast local regional Burning Man scene and raves and EDM and you know, so it's delightful. I mean, there's lots of stories in the book of like, we are the oldest people in the room, but people are coming up and like acknowledging us. But tell us a little bit about your entry into that and it being, you know, coming from an older generation, you know, EDM, electronic music, it's what the kids are into these days, you know, so just tell us about that entry and what you found there.
Well, Shelly and I started getting involved with the psychedelic community here in New York, and that's a very highly networked community where people really tell each other what's going on. And these all-night warehouse parties started happening here in Brooklyn, where a warehouse would be transformed for the night, just like the desert is transformed for the week out at Burning Man. And these were like all-night raves, and we would go with a posse of people. We were the oldest, but we had others with us too. And these were like revelations to us because we were nervous going in because of our age. But people would continuously come up to us all night and say, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for being here. You're an inspiration to me. You give me hope for growing older. And so that was a joy. And so we felt embraced and accepted by the community. Later on, we learned about PECS, the Philadelphia Experiment, and the PECS Summer Festival that went on for many years down in Maryland. And this was a whole weekend of EDM music and all kinds of installations, like a Burning Man light at a campgrounds with a swimming pool, about 1,000 people. And it was just ecstatic for the weekend. And of course, we would always roll for one night. And we felt so connected to the larger community. And so accepted and embraced by it. And there's something about the psychedelic community that I have found to be magical because it's very embracing and inclusive. And it embraces people of all ethnicities, although some people who are not white might feel like they don't belong in the psychedelic community. So we need to look at that and make sure that they feel included and do our best in that way. But it seeks to be inclusive. And certainly when it comes to sexual orientation and when it comes to age. And so it's something magical about it for us to be embraced in that way, and even looked up to as elders. Mm-hmm. So that our aging, which in the larger society looks like a liability, in this community looks like an asset, and is something that is valued. So it's been a very beautiful and transformative experience for Shelley and I.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you point out in the book, of how the scene is different today, with say within rave culture and psychedelic culture, Burning Man culture, versus what you were describing, you know, from back in the day when mm-hmm. when you were a younger man, and you know, these mantras of like, don't trust anyone over 30, and sort of a backhanded disrespect for age, to say that, well,
yes,
once you've aged, you're useless at this point.
Our generation has to do a big mea culpa, because we started this, don't trust anyone over 30. We really put ageism on the map here, made it even more of a thing than it was before we came along. Hope I die before I get old is the Who sang, you know? But things have changed. And in that way, they've changed for the better.
Yeah, and you write a lot about how the experience of MDMA for you has the feeling of recapturing moments and experiences of youth. And so maybe if you can talk a little bit about that, the perspective of being in your early 70s, yet having experiences that are very childlike or very youthful, very opening, and sort of managing that dichotomy, that you have some interesting statements about experiencing all ages versus...
Well, yeah. It's really what I like to call holistic aging, or even holographic aging. You know, the principle of a hologram is that any little piece, even a microchip in the hologram, contains the entire thing. Any part, I'll put it another way, at any age we are we can access all our ages. So I'm 72. I have an 8-year-old in me. I have a 4-year-old in me. I have an 18 and 28 and 38-year-old in me. And MDMA helps me access those parts of me and realize that right there, just below the surface, waiting to be connected with and waiting to revitalize me. Because like when I'm dancing on MDMA to EDM, I'm like, I have a 28-year-old body, and I can dance all night long. I have to sleep it off. I have to sleep a long time that night. But it's a thrill for me. And realizing that, these younger versions of me are really still available and can inform me and remind me of how great it can be, how great it can feel to be in a body, to be in my body, and that the vitality that I knew as a young man is not so far away as I thought.
Yeah. And so that's something that then you can access through the MDMA experience. So in a sense, that's kind of the bonus of being older, yet also working with these medicines, because a younger person can't really understand what it is to be older. The older we get, the more we understand how it is to be older. And when we look back and think of, whoa, wow, well, 10 years ago, I didn't know what this was going to be like, you know? Yeah. So we have this spectrum of experience, and you know, you are 23 years older, no, 23, 24 years older than I am. So you've got that much more experience, but then through these alterations and experiences, you're able to access everything that came before. And so there's such a palette to choose from of experience.
Yes. And one advantage of being a psychonaut at this age is it's like if one tripped on LSD, for example, when one was 20 and then did it again when they're 40, it's like you're bringing your whole self to that experience, and you're bringing 20 more years of experience to the acid experience. I liken it to reading a novel when you're a kid and then reading the same novel when you're older. It can be a whole new book.
Yeah.
So to be able to do MDMA at this age and revisit what it's like to be not only in my body at other ages, but it's like I liken being high on MDMA or another good psychedelic as taking a brief one-day helicopter ride above my life and looking out at the view and looking at where I've been, where I've come from, how I got here, and where I want to go. It gives me great perspective on the whole journey.
Yeah. Well, speaking of perspective, you know, you also write in the book how you decided to go into becoming a therapist and developing a practice. And of course, that's a big part of therapy is helping people get perspective on their life and on their experiences and their choices. But it doesn't seem, at least from what I've read in the book, that you have gotten involved in psychedelic therapy, MDMA therapy, you know, such as being developed by MAPS and things like that. But you know, as someone who is both a psychonaut and a therapist, I'm curious, how would you describe the perspective shifts that can happen through the psychedelic experience versus the therapeutic experience, and how they might work together, or how they're different from each other? I'm just curious how you would characterize that.
Well, I like to think of myself as an MDMA-inspired therapist. Mm. So my job in the therapy room with these sessions, which I do sober, I mean, I'm sober and the patient is sober. And I actually prefer the word client to patient because client is more of a peer-to-peer experience. The idea is to give them, as best as I can, the experience that I've known on MDMA, meaning to make them feel as safe and as held by me in this container that I create in that room as possible, so that they can relax, that they can relax their defenses and feel free and open and safe enough to talk about the hardest things in their life to talk about. Mm-hmm. So I try to give them, without telling them that I'm doing that necessarily, but I'm trying to give them that MDMA experience of being held, of being immensely safe, give them a feeling of well-being. And I do that by deeply listening to them and letting them know that I'm listening by letting them know what I'm hearing them saying, and letting them know what I think is going on with them, and having a dialogue, a real connection, a real person-to-person dialogue, where I come off the throne of I'm the healthy psychotherapist and you're the sick patient and all that nonsense, and just, no, I'm just a person here and with another person, and we're having a dialogue as two people, and my job is to listen to you deeply so that I can help you access your own wisdom, your own best solutions to your issues.
Nice. And correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed like both of these developed around the same time, that you're becoming a therapist and also this resurgence of interest in MDMA. Am I correct, or do I have the timeline wrong on that?
Well, I my the resurgence in my interest in MDMA started 20 years ago. I've been a therapist for about 33 years.
Okay. But then it does sound like your experiences with MDMA impacted, as you say, you became an MDMA inspired or informed therapist. So
yes.
So it made shifts in your own practice and how you interacted with clients.
Yes. Yeah. Instead of techniques, I mean, I have a bunch of techniques in my toolbox, but instead of an emphasis on techniques, like I'm trained in Gestalt work, and Gestalt is full of great techniques, very powerful techniques, but instead of an emphasis on that, it's really more of an emphasis for me in the therapy room of the quality of my presence and the quality of connection between me and the person, and really being there with them and for them, and to listen into and through their words and their heart and their experience, and bringing my intuition to bear, and bringing my body into the room, and encouraging them to do the same by me being in touch with what I'm feeling and them being in touch with what they're feeling, and speaking from heart to heart and gut to gut.
Sounds like it. We could say that maybe deeply humanized your practice rather than the intellect of, well, I'm the therapist and these are all the theories and the tools, and so let's apply them to you. But really, let's meet as human to human, as person to person, and open up this space and see what comes of it.
And how we can
help you. Yeah,
that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. And it's a humanizing space that it really happens through dialogue and listening. And people come to therapy, and this is my experience at least, but most people come to me. Yes, some come with very specific issues that they need specific solutions and answers to. But most people come to make connection, to really be heard and deeply received by another human being who's dedicated to just being there for that purpose.
Yeah. And I could see how experience with MDMA can certainly enrich that relationship and enrich that situation.
Yeah, because it's helped me get more in touch with myself and connect me to me, and help me know what it's like to deeply connect in an intimate way to another human being, like a friend, for example, to have a real heart-to-heart with a friend with our defenses down, and how profound that can be. And that's helped inform my abilities as a therapist.
Yeah, so in your book, you do have really some very practical guidelines and suggestions and outlines for doing MDMA with another individual, the idea of having a vacation within a vacation. And I love that. I've done that a few times. And just the idea that, you know, your experience on the weekend, in a sense, can be a vacation. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily need to go somewhere. And then also...
Like a staycation.
Yes, a staycation. And then also sort of, I guess, the group MDMA experience. So maybe if you could talk to us a little bit about what are some of these guidelines that you've established in the book for what you feel works best for these kinds of situations.
Well, there's a chapter in the book about group experiences, which are far and away the most ecstatic experiences that I have on MDMA or in my life these years. Getting together with a very well and carefully selected group of people, because who you're with is the most important part of your setting when you're on a psychedelic. And so I devote a chapter to how to curate these experiences and what to do when you have a bunch of people, a carefully selected bunch of people together for the day, who were committed to staying for the day and are committed to doing MDMA and only MDMA together. And the exercises that you can do together, but also the best part of it is actually just hanging out and being in this rare space together with the purpose of having what I called earlier serious fun and just connecting heart to heart. It's an ecstatic experience. And we do it every year here in Brooklyn in Prospect Park. And to people on the outside, it just looks like a bunch of people having a picnic because we take over a small area and we have our blankets out and our chairs and we're just sitting about and talking and munching on some light snacks. But no one else knows what we're really up to, and which adds to the kind of the pleasure of it.
That's fun.
It's fun, and we are connecting, and lifelong friendships have grown out of these experiences. We've been doing them for about 15 years, and people get to meet there and. At the end, all they want to know is, when's the next one?
Yeah.
And for weeks on end, they're saying, that was amazing, and I learned this, and I learned this, and I'm having this afterglow, and it stays alive for me for weeks and months. And we have a group chat on Signal, which is an encrypted app devoted, you know, for just the people who were there for that day. And those chats go on for years. Because of the depth of connection that happens from that day.
Nice. When did you decide to start sort of branching out in that sense? So, you know, in the narrative in the book that it's you and Shelley and going to these EDM raves and exploring all of that. When did the idea of having like these group sessions, when did that develop for you?
It was just, you ever hear the phrase, follow your bliss?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what I was doing. I love getting people together. I love MDMA. And I thought, well, so how can these two intersect? So I realized, hey, I have a bunch of really cool friends who would get along. And what better way to have them meet? So it was a natural idea for us to just host these things. I don't act as a therapist that day. I'm just sort of a host. But to get people together for that purpose has just been, it was easy because people jumped at the idea. They were glad to and grateful to have somebody else organize it. So, and then I wanted to give it away by having it as a chapter in the book, because anyone can do this.
Yeah. Well, this kind of seems to coincide a little bit with the idea of you sort of kind of coming out of the psychedelic closet that you talk about in the book and when you made the decision to inform other people that this is something that I do, this is something that I enjoy. And it's an interesting position coming at that at this stage in life. And it's not all that uncommon now at this point, because there is this resurgence of interest in psychedelics. So a lot of people who maybe did them when they were quite a bit younger are coming back to it for the first time.
Yes.
And finding that question of, well, who am I going to be open with this about?
Yes.
Who am I going to share this with? And one of the things that I think is very common is that people do want to be able to share it. And fortunately, even though there is stigma, and you know, you've mentioned psychedelics and people giggle, right? They get uncomfortable, like, oh, yeah, psychedelics. But knowledge is increasing. Exposure about these medicines is increasing. And especially, you know, like with the works of MAPS and things like that, that people are learning about the therapeutic applications. But still, there's this notion of, well, you're just a drug user, or you're a hedonist, or,
yes,
you know, you're being irresponsible.
Yeah, so, some people will judge you. And if you're very sensitive, like I am, you might want to be careful about who you come out of the closet to, because some people will judge you and stigmatize you and never look at you the same again. So I counsel people to be careful who you come out to. If you feel the need to, I mean, I felt the need to. I felt like I'm sick and tired of hiding who I am, and hiding and not being all I am. And I'm in a profession where I'm self-employed, so I don't have to worry about losing my job.
Yeah,
and I have plenty of good friends, so I don't have to worry about losing all my friends, because many of them are psychonauts. So not everyone is in my position, but you want to be careful about who you come out to and how you speak about it and how you roll it out, because there are people who won't understand, and the judgment that they have is all about fear. That's all it is. People in this culture tend to conflate all drugs. So when they hear about psychedelics, they're in their mind, they're pairing psychedelics with heroin and crack and meth and all of that, and it freaks them out. Or they're remembering a time back in their day when they had a bad experience, or a friend had a bad experience and ended up in the ER, and so that's their association with it. So it scares them, and from that fear comes their judgment. And so that's a lot to push against, and that's a lot to challenge people with. So their knee-jerk reaction will be judgment for many people, at least. Although that's changing now, and we're living at a time where more and more people are understanding that that psychedelics that people do psychedelics don't have a drug problem. We have a drug solution.
Yes, and a serious drug interest.
Yes.
Yeah. Where in your own life did you experience the most pushback with your own coming out and openness?
I am in a men's group. I've been in the same, we call it a men's team, actually, in the same men's team for the past 30 years, actually. And at first, they were like freaked out and thought that they had an addict on their hands and all this. So it took a long time to explain to them. I've been in a therapy group where I had the same kind of reaction, and some friends, some old friends. And a message from one of the old friends was like, "Aren't you a little old for this?" And it took me a while to realize the best answer to that, which is I've been around for a long time, and to care at my age what other people think of me, if anything, I'm a little too old for that.
That's a good one. So you also talk about the inspiration in terms of writing the book. So maybe you could share a little bit about that. And that was also part of the coming out process of, I am now going to be the author of this book about ecstasy.
Yeah. Well, it was because I wanted to come out of the closet. I wanted to tell this heartfelt story about how Shelley and I ventured into the forbidden world of psychedelic drug users back in the aughts and found that world to be enchanted. And how it opened our lives to friendship and fun and freedom. So I had a lot of motivations for writing the book and to spread the word, and spread the word about how MDMA can be good for life transitions, including into midlife and beyond. And also to talk about how MDMA is really it's the chemical of connection, like I say, but it's really emotional super glue for relationships. It really can bond people on a most profound level, and help a couple, I mean, Valentine's Day is coming up soon, can help a couple reclaim the lost heart and spark of their relationship and help them remember what that feeling was that got them together in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's really the chemical of connection. So I wanted to share about all that and let the world know that this is really, it's not a drug, it's a medicine. It has a whole variety of applications, and it can open up one's life. And if, and I need to say this again, there are risks involved. So if and only if you do it correctly, if you don't know what you're doing, you must not do MDMA. If you don't educate yourself on the protocols and the safeties that were developed all these years, if you don't know these things, you must not do it. You must educate yourself first. That's why part of the book is about how to do it safely. It must be pure. You must measure it. You must test it. And only buy it if you can test it. And there are dealers out there who will allow you to test it. And you have to have the right set and setting, the right mindset, and control over your environment, especially the first time. So you have to have all these protocols in place. You have to be adequately hydrated throughout the experience. And you have to sleep well and eat well after it for days on end to replenish your body. But if you follow these protocols, this can open up your life like an opened up mind to a whole... It can enhance your love affair. It can enhance your love of life and your love of yourself. Yeah.
And, you know, a word that has come up quite often from you within this conversation that I think is quite striking, that in contrast, where as many people age, there is certainly people feel more isolated, more disconnected. You know, people that they knew, they might be passing on. And, you know, people often describe sort of their older years as being quite lonely. Yet a word that has come from you many times during this conversation is friends.
Yes.
And it seems like by following these protocols, by having these gatherings, by inviting yourself into these experiences of new communities and new people, that you talk a lot about friends. And so your life is really enriched in that way of something to share with friends.
And, you know, during COVID, I think we all understand how important friendship is and how painful isolation can be. And we're social animals. We're meant to be together. And without togetherness and physical togetherness, where you're in person, and without that, a part of us withers. And MDMA is a way of reclaiming that connection, especially face-to-face. Somebody called me the other day saying, I want to do MDMA with a therapist, and they're far away, so we're going to do it over Zoom. What do you think?
Yeah.
And I said, don't do it. You're going to feel all dressed up and nowhere to go. You're going to want to be face-to-face, in person, with somebody. I want to do that in person. It facilitates connection and friendship, like you say, and can deepen a friendship and the quality of that friendship, because you can speak to this person who you already are connected with in a deeper way. And feel free to do that and share in a more profound way. And it can deepen your relationship for the rest of the relationship.
Yeah. There's something I wanted to ask you about writing this book. Is I'm just curious if at any point when you were writing it, you had doubts or second thoughts or asking yourself, my God, why am I writing this book? Or maybe you experienced this as well. I mean, I certainly experienced this when I'm writing a book that I feel like I'm sharing something that's important. I get very excited about it. It's like, I feel so enlivened by writing this. But I wonder, did you have any of that conflicting both. Dance within yourself. Yeah.
Both. Yeah. I mean, it was a labor of love. I didn't know what was going to happen with it and if it was going to be received and if I could find a publisher and how, you know, how the world would receive it and how my non-psychedelic friends and family would receive it. I had doubts about whether I should write it at all. I had friends advise me, don't write this book. What are you doing? You're encouraging people to do drugs? Are you out of your mind? You're doing a dangerous thing. You're going to hurt people. Mm-hmm. And these are friends who I love and respect. So I actually just incorporated their advice and realized that, oh, I have to write this book responsibly. I have to talk about the risks. They're right. There are risks involved. And I have to talk about them. And I have to be clear about who should not do MDMA. Somebody with a heart condition should not do MDMA. Somebody who's bipolar or has a history in their family of schizophrenia or paranoia or epilepsy, of they're epileptic or pregnant, they should not do MDMA. I have to include that and write responsibly about it. So I incorporated all that. And that's helped me deal with the doubts. But it was a labor of love, and I was driven forward by the desire to share this with the world.
Yeah. And so let me see. The book came out, I think it was 2020. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how has it been received?
Well, it's been glorious. It's been so wonderful. People who are not and will not ever do a medicine like or a psychedelic have loved the book because it speaks to them on various levels, like about aging, for example. Mm-hmm. It also tells a story of a boomer and a boomer's journey from hippie to where I am now, and people can relate to the book on that level, or people can relate to the book just as a love story. Like between me and Shelley and finding love in middle age. So there are all kinds of on-ramps to the book. But the community has embraced the book with open arms, and that's been wonderful. And people have reached out to us from all over the world, Martin, saying, come to Australia, come to Portugal, come to England and do readings there. So far, we've only gone to Colorado and done some readings there. But we've had all sorts of new friendships from all over the world, all over the country. It's been marvelous.
Well, it's kind of funny because in an ironic way, it's even though you're an elder, you're a fresh face in the scene. You know, that there is sort of an imbalance in overall psychedelic culture where there's a few people who have been at it a long, long time, and they're like the elders. And then there's a lot of younger people, but you're kind of filling in a gap of, well, here is someone who is just coming out in his elder years. It's not that you've been public about this for a long time, and now you've written this book about ecstasy, which is, there's dozens of books about ayahuasca. There's dozens of books about psychedelic mushrooms. You know, there's not a lot that's really been done just with ecstasy, and some of it has just been, the information that comes out from the therapeutic side, but again, not necessarily connecting with the joyful, life-enriching side of the experience.
MDMA has really been the orphan in the psychedelic community. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because it is a synthetic drug. Maybe because the money is elsewhere. The money is more in psilocybin and ayahuasca. And there are many reasons. And the only big book about MDMA that was written before mine was by Julie Holland, who wrote a book about ecstasy 20 years ago, which is a wonderful book. Even Michael Pollan's book doesn't go into MDMA because his doctor advised that he not do it because he has a heart condition. So for some reason, It's really not been given the attention that it deserves. I think that will change, however, because by this time, in a couple of years, it may very well be past the federal threshold. It's going to be the first psychedelic to pass the federal finish line of legalization. It's going to become a prescription medication, and that's going to change everything. And the last vestiges of stigma will fall down, and the demand is going to be huge because people realize that, yes, it's good for PTSD. Yes, it's good if you have social anxiety. And perhaps if you're autistic, it can help because they're researching that now. Yes, it can be good for a lot of things, but it can also be used for the betterment of well people. Mm-hmm. And to enhance their life, which is what we're talking about here today. And so I think the demand is going to be quite huge. And there will be my book for anyone who wants it. And so I feel like I'm sitting pretty with my book for the future, because it's a book that's not a technical book. It's not a dry book. It's a memoir. And it's, people say it's an easy, joyful read, so I'm very, very gratified about the reception the book has gotten.
Yeah, well, you know, just commenting on that it is a joyful read, it is an easy read, it's very accessible, and that, so, I mean, it was, Park Street Press, they sent me a stack of like 10 books, and like, here are people to interview on your podcast, and I was looking at all these books, and I was like, man, this is really intimidating. This is so much reading. This is going to be hours and hours. Like, what do I want to get to first? And so I kind of flipped through them. And I was like, okay, Listening to Ecstasy. I'm down with this. This will be really easy for me to get into and a pleasure to read. And it's not that I'm not looking forward to reading these other books. It's just that the tone of the book just... I read a couple pages, and that's when I reached out to you and said, hey, Charlie, let's do an interview. I'll get your book read by next week, because I just jived with it right away. I was like, okay, I can get this done. It's no problem. So it is a very accessible book, and I think it's very rich, just in terms of the expression of the human experience and human emotion and human connection. And it just has all these wonderful elements, and it's very personable with you and Shelley as the main characters.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So going beyond the book, and then we'll return to the book to wrap up. But going beyond the book, you had mentioned that Valentine's Day indeed is coming up. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have some ideas about how people might enjoy themselves on Valentine's Day with their loved ones. And so, we can go ahead and open up that part of our conversation.
Okay. Shush. Well, I like to say that Cupid's arrow is laced with MDMA. And so I have some ideas for celebrating your love with the love drug. And these ideas can apply to single people too. I tell single people that, you know, should get together with other singles for a friendship role for Valentine's Day. And apply some of these ideas to that. But of course, it can be great for taking your romantic relationship to a whole new level. Getting back in touch with the type of feeling that brought the two of you together in the first place. So some ideas. Here's an idea of going into the tub together and with spooning, so that one person is between your legs, the other person has their back to the tub, and the person with the back to the tub has their arm over the chest of their partner in the tub, and just that being in that very nurturing position with this warm or hot water around you. Maybe it should be a bubble bath. Shelley and I did this once. We were in a hot tub. It was an in-room hot tub on vacation And it was like both of us back in the womb. It was amazing. And it was so deeply nurturing and nourishing for the two of us. It was a very bonding experience. Something else we have found is at the end of a role, bringing some cannabis into the mix towards the end of the role, and having what I can only call sextasy, because it's hard for me to perform sexually on MDMA because it's an amphetamine, and it's hard for me to perform. But as the MDMA is wearing off, I smoke some nice sativa, and Shelley and I always end our time together this way. And for Valentine's Day, there's no better way to connect than to have this combination at the end of a role, and that can really be ecstatic and glorious. Another thing that two people can do is what I call a mirror dance, where you have some good music, and any kind of music, whether it's EDM or something softer. This works better with something softer and slower, where one dances and the other just mirrors them and follows them. And it can be, boy, that can be really intimate, and can make you bump up against all kinds of emotion, and it can be quite an amazingly intimate experience. And you see who is leading, who's following, and you can trade off who's leading and who's following. It can really deepen the quality of your connection. And you can also just sit facing each other, sit cross-legged facing each other, and complete the sentence: what I appreciate most about you is. And as one person goes, and the other person just listens, and then the other person goes, and keep speaking until you say it all the little things and big things that you appreciate about the other person, or what I really want to thank you for after all this time together is. And completing that sentence, and that can really deepen the connection and the feeling of warmth and love between the two of you, because it's you're being emotionally generous at that time, and the MDMA helps you erase any barriers you might have to being emotionally generous at that time, and just open your heart and express all the gratitude that you feel for all the little and big things that your partner has done for you. And if you're single and you're rolling with friends, of course, you can do this with friends as well. And if you want to take it even to a deeper level where it's a little more risky, you can have a sentence of, what I'm scared to say to you, but what I want you to know is, and then finish that sentence. Mm. And that can get quite deep, and the MDMA will hold you and help you feel safe to take that kind of risk with your partner. And I know couples who've done that, and Shelley and I have done that, and it can permanently deepen the quality of your connection.
I have kind of a technical question to ask you about this with the communication on MDMA. I'm curious if you have noticed anything that you would perceive as like alterations in the tone of voice or the energy of what is spoken in those states, and how you might distinguish that from having a, quote, ordinary conversation.
Yeah. It changes the tone because it is an amphetamine. It's not like Ritalin or Adderall. It's much gentler than that. But it does energize you. And for many of us, it feels like it's opening our heart almost literally, because it for me and for many people, there's a warm feeling in your chest. Mm-hmm. I like to liken it to the feeling of the sun itself rising in my chest, and that chest is right close to where the vocal cords are. So it helps imbue the voice with an extra layer of warmth, and that helps with the connection.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's. All sound like good suggestions for Valentine's Day and how to make the most out of it. So something I just wanted to come back to, and again, this is a personal question for you.
Okay. Sure.
But in the book, you do talk about your Jewish background, and the idea of God comes up in several different places within the book. I think one of the last places is mentioned is... you recommend doing a sensory deprivation float tank on MDMA and the experience of being wrapped in the loving arms of God. So I'm just curious how your own sense of connection to this concept of God, how that has changed and transformed through these experiences and what that means for you.
Wow. What I like about this interview is you're not afraid to go deep here.
No.
So not everyone who's interviewed me is in the same boat as you, so I'm appreciating what you're bringing to this very much. I don't know an easy answer to your question. It's helped me feel closer to God. Helped me to realize that God is love and wants me to not only love myself, but give my love away. And that's what we're here for. And that is the essence of spirituality, as far as I can tell. And to be grateful and to count those blessings and to be generous in expressing gratitude to others, and generous in giving all I got, basically giving all that I have away. I pray every day, and it's just something I do that just works for me. And a long time ago, I uttered a prayer saying, "Please, God, let me be all used up by the time I die." And I feel like that prayer has been answered and is being answered, because I feel like I'm using up all of me and making all of me available and useful, and all my experiences are being put to use. And that is a wonderful way to be alive. And because one lives when they give, and at least I feel like I do. And that also, for me, is the essence of spirituality and a connection to God.
That's a very beautiful answer, Charlie. You made me tear up a bit there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing all of this today. This feels like a pretty good place to wrap it up for today. And just want to remind the listeners that I'm speaking with Charles Winninger. Your book is Listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA. It's available. It's out there. Where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
Well, first of all, they can find the book on Amazon, or if they don't like Amazon, like some people don't like Amazon these days, they can go to the Simon & Schuster website. It's on there too. And they can find me by punching in listeningtoecstasy.com.
And that's your website?
That's my website.
Great.
Well, and they connect with me through there.
Is there anything that we've passed over that you'd want to share to?
Well, we hit on so many of the of what I want to say. I really believe that this medicine, you know, I find myself not wanting to be the new Tim Leary. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be the one who gets too enthusiastic and maximizes the benefits and minimizes the risks, and because I do want to be responsible. But you can tell how excited I am about the potential for this medicine to transform this society and transform the world. And I believe it really stands solidly in America's future as a way of potentially, possibly healing the toxic divides in this country, and helping people realize that we are all connected, that what we have in common is much more important than what our differences are, and we have more in common than we have differences, and that we're here placed on this earth to recognize that and to recognize other people as our brothers and sisters in disguise, and to bring heaven to earth, like I said. That's what we're here for. And I think MDMA is one powerful tool for that end.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Charlie, and thank you for sharing your life experience and your wisdom and your viewpoint from this point in your life of the value of this medicine in particular and psychedelic medicines in general. Really appreciated getting a chance to talk with you today. It's been very nice.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it, Martin.
Your pulse, this is your breath. Trust in your heart and forget all.